Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this edition, the close connection between bourbon and the white oak tree.
An American oak, which most all bourbon barrels, most of them, and most whiskey barrels, period, are made with American white oak, and it has what's called whiskey lactones, which provides a small amount of kind of coconut character, which enhances the spirits.
How Kentucky's flagship university is responding to the recent Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action.
I find what the court is doing now very similar in some ways to what the court did in the years after Reconstruction.
A most intense vocal competition comes to Lexington.
Preparing to sing for judges who are associated with the Metropolitan Opera is an opportunity to sing for them in a large space and then get feedback.
We have details of a concert in tribute to Paul Simon.
Partly we chose him because he has such an array of styles.
And another Eastern Standard radio play.
Will you please let this poor man do his job?
I'm not stopping him. He can mow if he wants. But he'll be working for free because I'm not going to pay for anything until April begins.
First up, to make bourbon, you need white oak. It's federal law. To qualify as genuine bourbon, as opposed to your run-of-the-mill whiskey, it must be aged in new, charred barrels made of white oak. And as we reported in our recent Rise series documentary about a plan to clear-cut portions of forest on the Kentucky-Tennessee border, as the bourbon industry booms, demand for white oak is soaring. Eastern Standard's Crystal Jones has this report on oak trees, the barrels made of them, and the bourbon those barrels contain.
A bourbon apocalypse. Okay, so maybe it's not that dire yet. But bourbon blogs, newspapers, and podcasts have been passing around a concerning headline. If you're a Kentuckian or a bourbon lover, or odds are both, you've probably heard mention of the growing concern in the cooperage and bourbon industries about the white oak trees. I spoke with those on the forefront of the movement to save the white oak to find out how the population currently stands in a look at how biology is balancing the bourbon industry on a white oak stave. Dr. Jeffrey Stringer, the chairman at the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources for the University of Kentucky, and one of the major players in the preservation and promotion of white oak.
Well, we've known some time, forest ecologists and foresters, others that work with our forest systems, that oak has had a hard time regenerating itself. And we've known that for quite a while, probably since the early 80s. It wasn't really until about 2010, 2012, before we really started to be concerned about watching white oak regeneration and ensuring that it would be sustainable.
Darren Morris, Forestry Extension Associate Senior at the University of Kentucky.
We had a series between 2012 and 2017. There were a series of meetings that happened between oak researchers and industry and others involved, including, of course, journalists and writers for newspapers and magazines. And that's when the information got out that white oak was not regenerating itself.
White oak is the preferred hardwood for cooperage. Cooperage, as you may know, is the craft of steaming staves or small planks into vessels. Referred to most often in the trades as a cask, it might recall a certain tale of a fellow from Amontillado. And it's worth a side note that a barrel is a cask, but not all casks are barrels.
Barrels for the bourbon industry are made from white oak. So Kentucky is one of the top 4 or 5 states when it comes to the growth of white oak.
That's Brad Boswell. He's a fourth-generation cooper and the CEO of the Independent Stave Company. The Boswells have been making barrels their business for over 110 years and currently operate 4 cooperages across Kentucky. In this story, it's not what's going into the barrels that make them unique. It's the barrels themselves. Bourbon barrels are made almost exclusively from white oak. It's the industry standard for a few reasons. Brad Boswell.
I mean, for bourbon, first of all, to be classified as bourbon, it must be aged in a new oak container or, you know, barrel, because it's the most suitable species for aging. So first and foremost, you know, when you properly season, toast, or char a barrel, create a lot of vanillin, or we'll call it vanilla, a lot of vanilla character, and people love vanilla. we call vanilla catnip for humans. I mean, everybody likes it. Also, whenever, you know, a tree is growing, it has to have stored sugars. And so whenever we toast or char that barrel, those sugars that are in the wood are, they are converted to caramel. And so now you get these caramel characters paired with vanilla characters. You know, now sound a lot like creme brulee that comes from a toasted and charred white oak barrel. Also, you know, an American oak, which most all bourbon barrels, most of them, and most whiskey barrels, period, are made with American white oak, and it has what's called whiskey lactones, which provides a small amount of kind of coconut character, which enhances the spirits as well. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, white oak also has just the right amount of tannins, touch of bitterness, which helps complement those sweeter notes, you know, provides some balance. So when I think about barrels, I think a lot about the, you know, the flavors and aromas and textures. But then also white oak is suitable for coopers because, saw it properly, it's liquid tight. And a lot of people don't understand that if you took a red oak tree, cut it into staves and made barrels out of the red oak, that barrel would just be seeping out the liquid over time.
Beyond the symbiosis of white oak and bourbon, there's a general concern for the species' well-being with regard to the role it plays in our ecosystem. Darren Morris.
In terms of, you know, an acorn as a food source for wildlife, white oak happens to be the most palatable of all the upland oak acorns. It tastes less bitter, so it's sweeter.
White oak provides for and attracts birds, black bears, white-tailed deers, rabbits, and hundreds of species of butterflies and moths to the forests of East Kentucky and beyond. Since the white oak and the acorns are so important, biologists began an annual survey to assess each year's crop of nuts. In 2022, the white oaks, on a scale of failure to bumper, came in cautiously in the middle at an average production. So how serious is the concern at this moment? Dr. Stringer.
So there's not an immediate issue as far as we're going to run out of white oak. However, because white oak takes 60, 80, 100 years to mature, and that's a long time, we need to be able to do things now so where when we start to have a problem 30 and 40 and 50 years out, right, we have the ability to deal with it. Because if you wait till then to try to fix the problem, it's too late.
Darren Morris.
When this regeneration or lack of regeneration continues to grow in the forest, we're going to likely have a much reduced white oak forest resource out there, unless we do something now. So from there, discussions continued to happen in 2017. The White Oak Initiative was formed.
With so much of our ecological and economical reliance on the white oak, it was obvious to all involved that there would need to be a plan in place on how to find a balance between growth and demand of the white oak. Dr. Stringer.
The cooperage industry, of course, is a forest industry. They're a wood utilizing industry, and they have a great relationship with forestry and forest management. They promote sustainable use of the forest. They promote good logging practices. They've been good partners relative to the management of our forest.
Fred Boswell.
So, you know, we are working with the University of Kentucky and the industry in general to ensure we have proper amounts of white oak in the future. You know, today we have a very plentiful supply of white oak. It's grown extensively over the past 50 years. But we also know that if we don't improve our harvest methods, that there is some risk that we could slow down the growth of white oak. And that's not a good thing. Everybody wants more white oak in their forest lands. Like we've said, it's the noble species.
Dr. Stringer.
So yeah, it's an ambitious goal, but the idea is that you want to try to get forests that has an abundant amount of white oak regeneration in it now. So when those are harvested or when, you know, a natural ice storm occurs or another event like that, that forest regenerates itself, it's going to come back in white oak.
But simply planting trees won't be enough. Although the oak is hardy, scientists and researchers must take into consideration the ever-changing climate. In the case of the white oaks, Dr. Stringer explains.
So we don't have a definitive answer of how white oak will work with climate change. Our guess is, though, it's going to be fairly resilient. And that means you're going to see some changes in the weather patterning. If the models are correct, white oak should hang with us here in Kentucky. It should be able to stay here. Potentially, climate change could help it. It all depends upon whether that climate change and the things that go along with it are going to create more competitors for white oak or not, other tree species that compete with growing space for it. Pretty resilient. We've got a pretty good chance that climate change will not severely impact it.
Specifically in eastern Kentucky, was curious if recent and projected flooding would have an effect on the species. And it does. And moreover, the presence of white oak directly affects the possibility of flooding, as Darren Morris explains.
So flooding and erosion are a concern. Oak forests, the upland oak forests that we're talking about, are riddled with ephemeral channels that drain during heavy downpour events, and intermittent channels that drain during the wetter seasons of the year, and perennial channels that are usually, if not flowing, have standing water somewhere. So all of those channels are affected by the flooding events. Erosion's a concern. A healthy, diverse forest means a healthy watershed. And the two have been tied together always.
The trio of industries have also invested in the future of the white oak at the deepest level, exploring the very genes of the species to hopefully discover how to further its likelihood of survival. Brad Boswell.
We're working with the University of Kentucky on some genome projects to make sure, looking out 100 or 200 years, that we have the best, highest quality of white oaks available, for saplings, seedlings, to make sure that what we provide to the public is, the type of white oak tree that's going to, be a really good hardy tree that has the best characteristics, for commercial uses, especially for cooperage.
Darren Morris.
What that has done is grabbed material, acorns, and genetic material from parent trees all throughout the range of white oak. And the parent trees are chosen because they show conditions that perhaps they're superior in nature. They're good looking trees, and grow that in the repository at the Maker's Mark Distillery at Star Hill Farm. And all of that genetic material is being grown there. So now all of a sudden, trees in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Arkansas and Georgia, we know how those trees will react.
It's exciting and promising for the white oak and the industries that rely on it, but will it be enough to study and plant new trees? It can take up to 70 years for a white oak to reach barrel-making age, and we've heard from experts that if we don't act now, we could see a decline in the white oaks within the next 30 years. So what else are the industries doing to keep the balance? Brad Boswell.
Continue to understand how important it is to properly manage our timberland, our forest. It's worth the investment to go in and evaluate your stands of timber and then make a decision on how you're going to harvest that.
Darren Morris.
A say in that everyone's concerns need to be addressed. It's not just industry. It's not just the bourbon industry who wants healthy white oak forest. It's not just the state mills and the sawmills. And it's landowners. It's National Wild Turkey Federation, U.S. Forest Service, and others. So I think it's everybody's concern.
In September of this year, Congressman Andy Barr introduced the White Oak Resilience Act, with its key provisions authorizing the Department of the Interior and the Forestry Service to actively participate in white oak restoration projects by harnessing private investment and establishing a White Oak Restoration Fund to support white oak regeneration on national forest. This, according to a press release from Barr's office. Boswell.
I mean, if we have more white oak as a percentage of the forest, then everybody wins. The wildlife loves white oak. The wildlife wins. The landowner wins if we have more white oak available, because it's a high value hardwood tree that they love to grow and sell. And of course, our industry wins, because our industry will have plenty of raw materials to continue coopering barrels out of the next, hopefully, 100, 200 years.
Kentucky simply wouldn't be the same without our beautiful forest and our bourbon. And these industries are uniting in true Kentucky fashion to maintain the future of both.
Like all other spirits, it pretty much involves farmers harvesting the grains to make the liquid, but also includes owners of the timberland, includes the loggers that have to cut the trees, it includes the stave millers, the coopers, the warehousemen and women. So, there's a tremendous amount of American resources and labor and heritage that goes into each bottle of bourbon. And a lot of that is centered around the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
And hopefully avoid the bourbon apocalypse.
Okay, and last question. Can you imagine a world without bourbon?
Oh, Lord, no. No, I cannot imagine a world without bourbon. It's been part of our heritage. I mean, I think the Whiskey Rebellion's a huge part of our country's independence and heritage. And, I just think that we'll see bourbon thrive and people enjoying bourbon for you know, the next 240 years. I really believe that. I mean, I think in this fast-paced world with, you know, technology, that people want to slow down, sit down with their friends and enjoy a drink that, you know, took, you know, so much time, skill and craftsmanship to, you know, to create. So I think bourbon is going to be enjoyed. I literally think for way beyond my lifetime, and I can't imagine a world without it.
For Eastern Standard, cheers. I'm Crystal Jones.
In a historic decision, the U.S. Supreme Court in June of this year effectively ended race-conscious admission programs at colleges and universities across the country. How Kentucky's flagship public university has since responded is Gerald Smith's focus for this latest in our series on racial justice and equality. His guest is Dr. George Wright, a prolific author, professor of history and African American and Africana studies, and an advisor to UK President Eli Capilouto.
Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Wright.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to begin with something that happened just a few months ago. A few months ago, the Supreme Court ruled that it's a violation of the 14th Amendment for institutions of higher learning to use race when making admission decisions. And so my first question is, how did the University of Kentucky respond to this ruling?
Well, let me say this, that in anticipation of the ruling, knowing which way the court would rule, the president and the president's cabinet, of which I'm a member of, we had been talking about the implications of the Supreme Court ruling and what the university would be required to do. And so once the ruling was made known, the president, the chief legal counsel, and everyone said that the University of Kentucky, a public university, at all times must abide by the laws of the state of Kentucky, the laws of the United States. I thought it was very interesting that the chief legal counsel then said to us, he said, and something of a metaphor, you could have used a lot of different ones. And that is, let's say that previously in going from Lexington to Cincinnati, Ohio, that we had always traveled on I-75. He said the goal is still to go from Lexington to Cincinnati, but we might have to go and buy some other routes, US 25, or maybe even some other things. That, in other words, the University of Kentucky, which had made a commitment to be open to all citizens of the state of Kentucky, and indeed everyone who wanted to be a student at the University of Kentucky, that goal was still intact. And that if race could no longer be used as one of the things that were that was looked at in trying to make some decisions, there were still other ways. And frankly, some of these had already been used by UK and other universities. So the bottom line was that the university was still committed to doing everything it could to have a diverse student population that most surely included African-Americans and other underrepresented groups.
Now, based on your experience as the president of an HBCU, what does the decision mean for historically Black colleges and universities?
Here's one of the things that I believe about the Supreme Court ruling, and I definitely believe this relates to HBCUs and others, that a lot of times when you talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, you can ask the question, does the Supreme Court set the tone for American society, or does its rulings reflect American society? I think the Supreme Court has done both of those. There's been times it's been in front of. I think in 1954, when the Brown decision was made, if a survey had been done by all Americans, and I'll generalize and say maybe all white Americans, definitely, they probably would not have been in favor of school integration, something that the Supreme Court came down with. Today, if a poll had been done saying the use of race, I think it would have probably been split in a way that was reflected in the court, specifically to Black schools. I wonder if ultimately, let's say, their enrollments might not be impacted. But here's my concern. Will some young people and their families, especially first generations, and I would say at HBCUs, but even at predominantly white schools, say that there's a climate in place, that the court ruling would say that they're not as welcome, and it might not encourage people to apply or to pursue as they might have previously? That you see, sometimes a court decision can be as much symbolic as anything else, but to the people who it greatly impacts, that symbolism means a lot. So I do worry if the court decision could lead in some instances to some people thinking that, well, in my country, people are not as concerned about me having the opportunity to pursue higher education, especially since that might not have been part of the background that I come from.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will increase enrollment interest in HBCUs?
It's possible that this ruling could have a more adverse effect than we could imagine, even on schools, even if they don't mention race in recruiting of students.
Mm-hmm. Well, this kind of leads to my next question. Do you think it's possible to eliminate the issue of race in the admission process?
Here's what I think universities had been moving toward. In some instances, there had been other court rulings, not the Supreme Court. But do recall that the Supreme Court itself had made several rulings on a Michigan case, on another North Carolina case, on a Texas case when I was at the University of Texas. And they had wondered if anything that looked like you were making Black people a special category in that regard was to be avoided. And so here's what universities and others had to do. They had to talk more about people from underrepresented backgrounds, people from lower socioeconomic groups, people from certain communities that within a state had not been fully represented at a university. So let's say in a place like Kentucky, that could mean not only African-Americans from a Louisville or a Lexington or a Hopkinsville or a Madisonville, but it could include whites from certain places. Eastern Kentucky may come to mind. From other places in the country, that could mean people who are from Native American backgrounds or from Hispanic or Mexican American or Latina backgrounds. So I think there are ways that you will incorporate African Americans without necessarily specifically saying them. And I find what the court is doing now very similar in some ways to what the court did in the years after Reconstruction. Recall the passing of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, giving Blacks certain rights. But then almost immediately, our government, led by the Supreme Court, led by Congress, began to chip away at those, going so far as to saying that the 14th Amendment had made Blacks a special ward of the government. And they said that's not something that was intended. So here's a group coming out of slavery who had been in a situation unlike others. The court is now saying, no, everybody still has to be treated the same. And we cannot do just special things for that group. So I find that a parallel, and whether one want to call it interesting or tragic, I think it is the reality of what has happened in our country.
Do you think the ruling will result in a drop of Black and Latino students?
I worry that groups who are underrepresented already will take that as a sign, which when you're not saying directly, we want more Black students to come, we want more Latina students to come, to mean the absence of saying that may be interpreted by them as saying you don't want more of us there. That's what I worry about.
Well, let me shift gears just for a moment to another topic. For more than a year now, there have been discussions about critical race theory, the banning of certain books on topics of race, and there are now even debates on how Black history should be taught. So what is your opinion of the challenges and changes to the curriculum standards regarding the teaching of race in American history?
What I find consistent about this is that from the time I first started teaching, let's say in the mid-1970s to the present, there have always been people who somehow wanted to doubt the legitimacy or the validity of what comes under the heading of Afro-American history or race relations and so forth in a way that they don't doubt others. I've always said that if I make a statement, you have a right to say, what is that statement based on? And since you're a historian, tell me the sources. And so I could be talking about one of my books on lynchings or race riots and give examples. And then I would say, these come from white observers who witnessed this. In some instances, some people were so proud they mentioned, they gave their names and things. And now you're going to tell me that's not a legitimate source? But just go to World War II. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the person who would become the most distinguished historian, John Hope Franklin, is in Durham, North Carolina, and he reads an ad in the Durham newspaper that said, we need college-trained men to join to do all sorts of things. John Hope Franklin goes down there and they said, you're the wrong color. We don't need someone like you. Or you take the experiences of my own father and my future father-in-law. They were soldiers in World War II, yet they come back home and are denied certain rights that German prisoners of war can have. And when you say things like this, other people say, no, no, that's not true. Then you say, well, just read in the Lexington paper or the Louisville paper or pick your paper or see what the governor of Georgia said during World War II and things like it. So when they're talking about critical race theory, I would say, what are you now saying that's not accurate about it? Folk aren't coming up with things that are stories that have no validity and so forth. But this is something that we've always faced.
Mm-hmm. One final question, and that is, how can we advance racial equity despite the Supreme Court rulings and the challenges to Black history?
I don't think we are prohibited by our courts from reaching out to other people, by trying to find ways to encourage young people. And it could be young people who, quote, look just like us, or young people who don't look like us. And I really do believe that those of us who've had an opportunity to go to school or to obtain certain kinds of jobs, to have a certain living standard, we have a responsibility to then try to make sure those same opportunities are extended to other people.
All right. That's Dr. George C. Wright, Distinguished University Research Professor and Senior Advisor to the President of the University of Kentucky. I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard.
Coming up after the break, some exceptional voices are about to appear before a panel of judges in Lexington, and no pressure, but
they're looking for singers who would be a good fit to sing on the Metropolitan Opera stage.
Plus, local artists to pay tribute to songwriting great Paul Simon. And
$50 a pop, 4 times a month. This is a robbery.
That's what the contract stipulates, sir. I only mow the lawn. I'm not involved on the money side.
Our latest 10-minute radio play. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Prestonsburg's Mountain Arts Center will present Dancing for Shelter, Eastern Kentucky's own version of Dancing with the Stars, 7 p.m. November 3rd. For information and tickets, visit macarts.com. Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling will host an opening reception for its monthly exhibit titled Emerging from the Mountains, from Appalachia to the World, 5 to 7 p.m. November 3rd. This exhibit features work by Morehead State University art students. For more information on this exhibit, visit grackentucky.org. And Lexington Children's Theater presents the world premiere of The Reluctant Dragon, 2:30 p.m. and 7 p.m. November 11th. For information and tickets, visit lctonstage.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Carrying us into this next segment is the voice of Ben Strong, the 2022 Kentucky District winner in the Metropolitan Opera La Fante competition. The competition is designed to discover promising young opera singers and assist in the development of their careers. The 2023 Kentucky District competition is coming up on November 4th in Lexington. And joining us with details is District Director Casey Nardalillo. Casey wears a lot of musical hats in addition to this one. She's also Executive Director of the Chamber Music Festival of Lexington and the Lexington Chamber Orchestra. She is Head of Voice for the Prague Summer Nights Music Festival, Instructor of Voice at Center College, and Chorus Master for University of Kentucky Opera Theater. Welcome, Casey.
Thank you, Tom. My goodness, I got tired just listening to you list off my jobs.
I know, you're one really busy person. So tell us about this competition coming up on November 4th.
Well, this is a wonderful competition that the Metropolitan Opera has been hosting for years and years. And the Kentucky District has been in Lexington, sponsored by Opera Lex. This will be its 23rd year. And we're so happy to be one of the districts for the competition. There are actually 36 districts across the United States and Mexico and Puerto Rico. And singers apply to the competition. These are usually college age, maybe just out of grad school age singers. And they submit videos or, audio recordings of an aria, and all of the staff for the Met competition listen to those applications, and then they choose qualifying singers. So, for instance, to give you an idea of the scope, this year there were 1,500 applications, and they have advanced 925 singers who then are able to qualify for the district level. Of the 36 districts, Kentucky is one of the first, and those run through January, and then the regional competition starts. So a singer will come to Kentucky, and we have 26 this year, and they'll sing from their list of four arias, two arias for a panel of judges that the Metropolitan Opera recommends we use. And these judges are listening for raw talent. They're listening for a unique sound. They're listening and watching for the acting and the communication. And they're looking for singers who would be a good fit to sing on the Metropolitan Opera stage at some point in their young career.
So those that are competing in this district competition, where do they come from?
Well, they're actually from all over. Once you qualify for the competition, you don't have to be associated with the district where you register. Sometimes it's because they want to sing on a certain day, because each district has a different competition date. But Often it will be someplace that's close to where they're in school or someplace where they're where they have family. So we do have several singers from the University of Kentucky Opera Theater program. We'll have some singers from the Cincinnati Conservatory and the Indiana University School of Music. But then we also have some kids drive up from Nashville or Atlanta, sometimes flying from New York, just depending on when they choose to sing in their district.
From the perspective of the singer, what exactly is at stake here? How can this be a life-altering experience for both the winners and those who don't succeed?
Well, anytime a singer has a performance opportunity, they bring a different level to their singing. So preparing to sing for judges who are associated with the Metropolitan Opera is an opportunity to sing for them in a large space and then get feedback. So each of our contestants will have the opportunity to sit down and meet with our judges after the competition, after they announce the winners. And the judges will say, you know, you did this thing really well, but this is what you need to work on. And sometimes the judges feel like they hear someone who's got great potential, but they're not ready to move on. But then the singer has the opportunity to stay in touch with that judge, and then sometimes they can open doors for them or advise them down the road. So it's really about opening up the opportunities for the young singers to have up close and personal time with these judges after they've heard them sing.
What can you tell us about the mental focus that goes into preparing for this competition?
Well, I mean, anything associated with the Metropolitan Opera is going to make you bring your A game. And so it does take really intense focus. You have to be thinking about the opportunity for singing for someone who has connections, who can help you. But as I tell my students so often, singing is a multitask activity. You have to have a good vocal technique and know your instrument, which is inside your body. So every day is a little different. You have to know what you're saying, because often in opera, you're singing in a foreign language. You have to communicate very deep emotions. And so the judges are watching and listening for a singer who's not just standing there making a beautiful sound, but for someone who's really telling a story and being true to the musical style of the different periods that the arias come from. And so there's just a lot to think about. It's a multitasking activity that has a lot of adrenaline associated with it, because singing for these judges is an exciting opportunity, and also to get to hear other singers who are singing at a high level.
Okay, it's going to be good to have that knowledge, that background when we come to the competition. And so where will it take place, and will it be open to the public?
Yes. So Opera Lex has been sponsoring this competition for the Kentucky District, as I said, 20 some years. And the competition is on November the 4th at the Singletary Center for the Arts Concert Hall in Lexington on University of Kentucky's campus. The competition will begin at 10 a.m. We have 26 singers registered. And so each singer will have a 10-minute slot. We'll take a lunch break halfway through and then hear the second half of singers. The judges will deliberate, and then we will be awarding over $5,000 in prize money to the singers who participate. The judges get to select if there's one or two, maybe even three winners, and those students will have the opportunity to move on to the regional competition, which we are part of the Central Region, which is in Chicago. It includes Indiana and the Illinois districts. And so we'll have one or two singers move on to that in January. And then we also award some encouragement awards. So if a judge hears a singer who shows great promise but is not quite ready for the next level, we get to give them a little encouragement prize and money that helps them continue their studies to improve their skills.
That's Casey Nardalillo, Executive Director of the Chamber Music Festival of Lexington and the Lexington Chamber Orchestra. Thanks and good luck, Casey.
Thank you so much.
The Chamber Music Festival of Lexington is a supporter of WEKU. This year's Music for Mission tribute, coming up on Friday, November 3rd at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington, honors this iconic voice.
You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, leave, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back.
Here with details of this year's concert is organizer Anita Courtney of Purple Carrots Productions. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Anita.
Thank you.
So first, a little background on this series, if you would. Mostly local musicians involved, right?
Yes.
And past tributes have honored Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, John Lennon, Stevie Wonder, Dolly Parton, and now Paul Simon. Why did you choose Paul Simon?
Last December, CBS did a Paul Simon tribute, and at least 10 people called me and said, this has got to be your next tribute. Partly, we chose him because he has such an array of styles, so it makes for an interesting concert. And also, one of our committee members, just not even looking ahead at his discography, listed 18 songs that he considered to have must-have songs. So he's just got such a beloved catalog, such a varied catalog.
It's safe to say that there are a lot of local bands and groups out there working on their song or two, correct?
Yeah, we have a great variety of artists. We have The Swells, we have Marcus Wilkerson, we have Lilac, we have an 11-year-old girl who does just a rocking version of At the Zoo. We have Naveem, which includes Philharmonic musicians. So that's just a small taste of the people who are out there working on their Paul Simon. One of the things we're excited about is the First Presbyterian Church Choir is going to do some backup on the songs and just add a lot of texture and just inspiration to the show.
I just listened to the Malcolm Gladwell documentary series on Paul Simon, and it's amazing. And I think what really caught my ear was the depth and the breadth of his songwriting. It doesn't conform to any one particular genre, does it?
No, he is just evolving song after song, album after album, using music from all over the world, harmonies like we never heard before. Yeah, he's doing some great work.
So is this a ticketed event? How does that work?
Just go to eventbrite.com and search Music for Mission Paul Simon Tribute, and it'll pop right up. The tickets are free. In exchange, the audience is asked to make a donation to the featured nonprofit, and that's Kentucky Refugee Ministries. Using this model, where we have sponsors pay the musicians, the Music for Mission series has raised over $170,000 for local nonprofit groups.
People might wonder why you have to register for a free ticket, but I'm sure that has to do with crowd and capacity, right?
Exactly. There are 400 seats in the church, and they go like hotcakes. So people need to get them early so they'll have a seat.
That's Anita Courtney of Purple Carrots Productions on this year's Music for Mission tribute to Paul Simon. It's coming up on Friday, November 3rd at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington. Thanks, Anita.
Thank you, Tom.
With all the world's trials and tribulations, sometimes the distraction of a little theater of the mind can be useful and fun, even if the main character and his wife are, to say the least, one very grumpy couple. Line of Duty by Johnny Payne is the latest in our series of radio plays, written, directed, and acted by local talents.
What are you doing here with the mower? It's still March.
Sir, you signed a contract for our services. We've fertilized, seeded, and mulched. That's made the grass grow. I know it's early in the season, but the grass is getting thick.
Hey, Russell. Hey, Stan. Whose fault is that? You shouldn't have put so many seeds down. You shouldn't have mulched so much.
Sir, the whole reason people use lawn services is because they want the yard thick and lush. They want it to look like Augusta National.
I want my spread to look like a golf course. A slow-growing golf course.
This is Jessamine County, Kentucky, not Sedona, Arizona. There's been a lot of spring rain, more than usual.
I'll blame it on global warming, climate change, always an excuse.
I blame it on mighty Jehovah. He controls the weather, not me.
Well, Jehovah's not doing his job.
You'll have to take that up with him.
$50 a pop, 4 times a month. This is robbery.
That's what the contract stipulates, sir. I only mow the lawn. I'm not involved on the money side.
Russell, will you please let this poor man do his job?
I'm not stopping him. He can mow if he wants. But he'll be working for free because I'm not going to pay for anything until April begins. That's the beginning of spring.
March 20 is the beginning of spring, the vernal equinox. It's been the beginning of spring since the beginning of time.
Somebody must have made that up off the top of their head.
Astronomy made it up. Sometimes the date falls on the 20th, sometimes the
23rd. How do you know to blame much about the skies?
Unless you're on the Gregorian calendar.
I never heard you mention anything about equinox.
Equinox. I read books, Russell. It has to do with the position of Earth relative to the sun. It's a time of balance. 12 hours sunlight, 12 hours dark. The sun crosses the celestial equator.
I read books.
The one stuck between your high school baseball trophies?
I've read almost everything John Grisham ever wrote.
Today is March 20. So this lawnmower man has come on exactly the right day. The inaugural day of spring. He's like that person who throws out the first pitch of the baseball season. To put it in language you can understand.
All right, Mr. Mower. I now understand that you may be right according to the calendar, but it doesn't sit right with me.
If we don't take care of the grass now, it's going to choke my riding mower.
You want me to spend my hard-earned money, that's all.
Which is not only dangerous and could overheat the engine, or the excess grass on the fresh-cut lawn will turn brown and I'll have to come back and clean it up, and we'll have to charge you extra. Either way, you'll spend money.
On top of which, this man has a limp. And here he is, standing on that bad leg, and the clock is ticking.
Blanche, he can hear you.
I know he can hear me. I'm not insulting him. I'm stating a fact. He knows as well as I do that he limps.
Sir, this is a business. We try to give a good product for what you pay. Check our Yelp reviews. All 5 stars.
How did you come to be that way, you poor soul? Was it the war?
I live with it every day of my life. I did serve my country, but I was fortunate enough not to be wounded in battle.
Thank you for your service. What was your job?
Oddly enough, I mowed and kept grounds at Camp Nelson, the National Cemetery close by here. One day on a hillside, my mower flipped over and broke my leg bones. Right about crushed them. They didn't heal quite right, and the accident left me with a limp.
Bless your soul. Wounded in the line of duty, I'd say.
I expect no accolades. Any other soldier would have done the same.
They should have given you a Purple Heart.
This is ridiculous.
Kind of you to say, ma'am.
Mowing lawns is not the same thing as actually doing any fighting.
Russell Merriweather Bartlett, you had best not say one single soul solitary word against this honorable man.
I have not taken his name in vain, much as I'd like to.
You didn't even serve in the military whilst this gentleman gave his good right leg, sacrificing it to the honor of our republic and the well-being of thousands of fallen and otherwise deceased soldiers whose memories he burnished by keeping Camp Nelson looking as good as Augusta National.
If I'm not mowing one lawn, I'm mowing another. I want you to understand that I don't make more wages, no matter how long I stay. The boss gives me a set amount per mow, and I have to make do with that. Your money goes straight to him, not me.
I've driven past that cemetery many times, and by heaven, you could play golf on that surface if it wasn't for the terrain being so hilly that your ball would roll straight out onto Route 27.
Nobody would ever play golf at the cemetery.
Here's what's going to happen. This man is going to mow our lawn as scheduled today on the vernal equinox and on any other day that he pleases because he knows better the rhythms of the earth. Now, do I make myself clear?
Yes, too clear.
Furthermore, you will offer him a decent cash tip afterwards so he can feed his family. You will walk outside when he's finished and lay those dollars in his palm with a smile on your face and a song in your heart.
Miss Blanche.
Otherwise, and if you don't agree to these conditions, you will come right out here and mow it yourself every single week. And then you'll rake it all up into piles and put them into the recycle bin and take the dead grass straight to the town dump.
I'm eternally grateful, ma'am.
Lawnmower man, you go right ahead and do what you do. I know it's not a hot day, but I will bring you a beverage out here whenever you want to take a break because you're thirsty or just want to rest your poor benighted leg. Would you like coffee? A Coke?
Water will do me fine and much obliged.
Russell, is there anything you'd like to say to the gentleman before he gets started?
No.
You danged well better say something.
Thank you for your service.
Line of Duty is a play by Johnny Payne. Paige Lambert as Blanche, Jonathan Hibbard as Russell, Matthew Lewis Johnson in the role of the mower. Sound design by Neil Kesterson. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.